Good morning, everybody, and thank you for being here. So I'm going to talk about establishing systems and protocols, a model for protecting maternal and child health facilities from Ebola virus and other infectious diseases. And my colleague, Mary Koma, will talk about the implementation of that protocol in Sierra Leone. We have nothing to disclose. This session, start with an introduction, talk a little bit about the virus, not much. Go on to factors affecting the spread of Ebola, strategies to reduce transmission, the protocol itself, and the adoption of the protocol in maternal hospitals, and then we'll close out. So the virus was first identified in Zaire in about 1976 near the Ebola River, which is how it got its name. And in that epidemic, there were only 318 cases of what then was identified as a hemorrhagic fever. It's since been called Ebola virus disease. Between 1976 and 2014, there were a number of different epidemics, and the virus that was most recently spread in West Africa was the Zaire virus, the same virus, and it was one of filovirus strain, and also the most extensive epidemic. The three countries that were most affected by this virus were Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. There were 28,512 individuals who were infected, and about 11,313 individuals who actually died as a result of the virus. The case fatalities varied slightly between Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone actually having the lowest case fatality. I'm not quite sure what that is, but it's a good thing. The impact of the epidemic was quite extensive in Sierra Leone, which I can speak to. Very similar findings, however, in Liberia. We know much less about what happened in Guinea. But there's certainly a loss of income from salaried jobs. A lot of people lost their jobs as a result of the epidemic. And that was because of distancing. A lot of people did not want anybody who was likely to be infected, who've come from our country, who've come to the city from the places that were first thought to be, well, in Kenema, our country, where the virus was first identified near the border with Liberia and Guinea. And anybody who came down from up there or visited family ended up losing their jobs because people were just scared. So loss of livelihood. A lot of farms were abandoned, again, because of fear. A lot of people did not know how the virus had spread, didn't understand how the virus had spread, and therefore abandoned their farms. Lots of family people died. Sometimes families, many as 35 people would die from one case. Sometimes loss of 17 members of one family as a result of the Ebola epidemic. Loss of community trust. People stopped trusting each other. Distancing again. Handshakes were, I mean, now if you go to Sierra Leone, Guinea, or Liberia, and you try and shake hands or hug, it's not acceptable. And that's all as a result of the Ebola epidemic. Loss of lives, completely unrelated to the epidemic. So a lot of people died not as a result of Ebola, but died not getting health care, essentially. There was fear of infection. Healthcare sector staff were really scared. We lost about 300 nurses right at the beginning of the epidemic because, again, they just didn't know what was happening. Nobody knew that the epidemic was what it was caused by, how people were dying. So it took quite a while before people understood this epidemic, and therefore we lost a lot of healthcare staff because when people went to the hospitals, that's who they encountered and they could become infected. Closure of hospitals, clinics, patients were not allowed to be seen, doctors were no longer allowed to visit patients. So there's quite an extensive impact of the epidemic. And in October 2014, which was soon after I left Sierra Leone, this is what the map looked like. A lot of cases spread right across the region, as many as 400 cases in a 21-day period, which is quite extensive. So factors influencing the spread of Ebola, the personal factors, denial. A lot of people just did not want to believe that this virus was causing the problem that it was. A lot of people put it down to lack of knowledge and lack of understanding. And my involvement in a research study that we did earlier this year resulted in this quote. Well, you see why some of them don't believe. One is this lack of education, and the literacy rate is high in this community, and people still adhere to their native customs. They don't want to leave their native customs. And the native customs included burial practices, they included care of the sick. In African tradition, people do look after their sick, and when somebody is sick, they don't immediately assume, oh, this is Ebola. They cared, and because they cared and looked after the individuals, they often lost their lives as well. No burial practices. A lot of traditional families will bury within 24 hours. Muslims and traditionalists will bury within 24 hours. And this urgency to bury also came with an urgency, a cleanliness, wanted to clean and make sure the body was safe. And as a result, a lot of people got infected. I don't want to spend too much time on this, although it's quite interesting. Other strategies for infection control within the healthcare setting, information, education, and communication strategies were quite extensive, both for the healthcare workers and the population at large. And there were a lot of media involvement in educating individuals, both traditional healers, religious leaders, general population. Because traditional healers were still involved in caring for individuals who were sick, as they'd always done. But when the traditional healers themselves started dying, then people started realizing they no longer had the powers to cure. And we had all kinds of stories about witch guns and witch aeroplanes and all this sort of thing, which were, again, going back to the traditional beliefs and customs. There were laboratory services, there were Ebola treatment centers, so extensive use of the media, as I said. Safe burial practices became quite an important strategy for prevention because of burials being so important in the spread of Ebola. We heard of 35, 40, 50, 60 people being infected as a result of one burial, particularly in leaders of the various societies. The individual efforts contribute, and that's where the protocol comes in. So the rationale for the protocol was really, sort of thinking about, oh my goodness, really thinking about how do we stop the spread of this virus? What can we in fact do to stop the spread of the virus? So we needed to reduce fear, we needed to reduce the spread of infection, but we also needed to try to get back to the gains that Sierra Leone had made, and Liberia and Guinea had also made in the context of maternal and child health. And these were the symptoms that became the targets, as it were, of thinking about how to prevent the spread of infection. These were signs and symptoms of the virus that individuals became aware of very quickly. And in thinking about how the virus is spread and what the categories are that people potentially seek care, there were really potentially five major categories. There's a category of emergency, where you had no idea whether the person was infected or not. You also had four additional categories. One where there's not likely to be infection, but you couldn't really tell. There's no 100% guarantee. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but there were four potential categories where people could be infected. And the protocol was really developed in order to ensure that those four categories of individuals who were likely to be infected did not enter the healthcare facility. So the protocol had three major legs, as it were, strands: screening and testing, physical and personal protocol protections, and strictly enforced policies. Those were the three major strands. The risk assessment form was a major part of that because. And risk assessment form was used everywhere. It was used in all the healthcare facilities, and it's actually still being used in airports. It's very similar, adapted slightly for the purposes of this project. But the questions remain the same about whether you've had fever, whether you've had exposure to somebody with Ebola, and whether you've had been a burial, because burials became a major issue. And there were three risk categories identified. One where there was fever. But fever could have been there's malaria, and there's all kinds of things that result in fever. So it's very difficult to tell just with fever whether it was Ebola. And then you have risk category 2 and then risk category 3. Risk category 2 and 3 could have been both Ebola. Risk category 3 was more likely to be Ebola because you also had physical contact with a corpse that had Ebola, right? So those are three major categories. And then, of course, there's the unknown category. And this is a patient flowchart. So for the implementation of the protocol, you had the single security entrance where everybody had the screening, and a negative screening resulted in triage 2 station where again the screening was done. And the reason why we had two stations was because what we'd heard earlier in the epidemic was people did not admit at the first station that they may have been in contact with somebody who had Ebola. And when they got to the second stage, it was more likely to be a nurse and the doctor, and they were more likely then to say, because they had symptoms, that they had been in contact with. So we had two stations. So negative screen then went out to MCH services. Positive screen followed the rest of the protocol. ERI2 and ERI3 were separated, and the reason why they were separated was because of the high risk of Ebola for ERI3, and therefore they were more likely to go directly to testing as opposed to ERI2. So we separated them because the risk was too high. We didn't want to get cross-contamination. So this was essentially the model. Triage station 1 and 2 had the screening. High-risk patients, ERI 2 and 3, and emergency patients went into isolation, separated because of the level of risk, and no-risk patients were allowed to go directly to clinic services. And Mary will take over now and talk about the implementation of the protocol in Sierra Leone.
Thank you. Yes, I will try. Good morning. My name is Mary Okumu. I'm the UN Women Representative in Sierra Leone and worked with Dr. Harris from the beginning of the epidemic. Now, the key interventions in implementing the model had to do with the retraining of healthcare workers and the entire administrative staff in the maternity wings, decontamination and re-equipping of the maternity wards and newborn centers, health worker confidence building. We lost 322 nurses, 11 qualified specialized medical doctors, and then the community completely had no confidence in the healthcare system. Nobody under those contexts wanted to go to hospital for anything. So they hid their patients. So this protocol was quite a major reopening of the utilization of health services. We had to work with the communities and their leadership. If you recall, traditional leaders who have a lot of power also died. And so if doctors died, nurses died, and your traditional healer died, I mean, you can imagine that context. So this protocol was extremely important in working on the demand and supply side of the service delivery and revamping the health facilities. These things seem very mundane or too small, but they were really major hurdles to overcome. Looking at the community dialogues was key. We trained more than 200 health facilities. We piloted this model in 2 maternity hospitals, and now when we opened the services to the first patients who came in, we almost forgot to implement the model on the day that the services were reopened. The communities were very excited, the health workers were very excited, and so everybody just went to the mothers in the wards to congratulate them, to hold the babies, and it was thousands of people streaming in for services. We forgot on that particular day to remember the one entry to follow the protocol. It was really hard, but eventually we were able to control and go back to implementing the model. What has happened is that the uptake of delivery in maternity hospitals has increased, and the Ministry of Health in Sierra Leone has endorsed this model. It's being replicated in 42 health district hospitals, but it is also going to be implemented at the MRU, the three countries at a regional level. It's been a very successful model, and in concluding, I just wanted to share with you that the protocol did serve to ensure that the standards were followed consistently and throughout the system. Infection control is critical for confidence building, because the mothers who had delivered in these facilities were the best advocates. They, when they went home with a baby and they themselves were alive, in fact, the services were better than before Ebola outbreak. And so the model, informed by evidence and aligned to the felt needs and priorities of the people, as well as community engagement, became part of its resounding success. And today, we are standing on the 7th of November. We are sure and are hopeful that Sierra Leone will be declared free from the outbreak, not free ever from Ebola, but from this current outbreak. And so when I leave and go back to Freetown, I look forward to the end of the epidemic. And this protocol was part of that journey. Thank you very much.